Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Tuesday, folks, which means it is time to ask the doctors. 1-800-423-8255. Less than half an hour ago, Governor Baker tweeted that Massachusetts has hit its goal of vaccinating 4.1 million residents. Meanwhile, President Biden says today that the country won't reach its goal of a shot in the arm of 70% of adults by July 4th. And the Delta variant is here and it's spreading fast. So what questions do you have about the risk from Delta, vaccinations for kids, if we'll need boosters, that nagging question about whether and when to wear a mask? Call us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus and vaccine questions. Joining us this week for Ask the Doctors, Dr. Benjamin Linus, an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, an associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine, and Dr. Gabriela Andujar Vazquez, an infectious disease physician, associate hospital epidemiologist, and medical director of the COVID-19 vaccination program at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Andujar Vazquez, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Dr. Linus, welcome back to you too.
Sure, a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Dr. Andujar Vazquez, I'll start with you. We hit 4.1 million fully vaccinated today in the Commonwealth. Governor Baker tweeted it just last hour. Is this a moment of celebration? Is it a moment of caution? How do you feel about it?
I think it's a celebration. You know, we have a lot of caution and other things around surrounding the pandemic. I think we should celebrate that milestone for the state and continue to encourage everyone who has still not gotten vaccinated to go ahead and do so.
Dr. Linus, do we know that number, 4.1 million adults? Is that a political number, some kind of public health tipping point number? Is there magic in that number? Or is it more that it's just a big one?
Well, I don't think there's magic in the number, but I also think that it's that it does reflect the public health concept. There's been lots of discussion around the concept of community immunity or population level immunity. And when about two-thirds of our population have been vaccinated, combined with the natural immunity that we unfortunately have from the pandemic, it seems likely that we are approaching the level of roughly 90% population level immunity when you combine those two things. And in some work that I've been working on and others as well using simulation models, that kind of coverage does look like the amount of coverage that we need in order to enjoy some level of community protection. So I think it is a reason to celebrate for sure.
Okay, so I want to, that made my ears perk up. Are you essentially saying that this is the number where, because between the number of adults vaccinated and what we believe is the immunity that a certain percentage of the population has obtained through having the coronavirus, we are reaching a point of herd immunity in the Commonwealth, understanding that our borders are permeable and, you know, et cetera. Is that what you're saying, Dr. Linus?
Effectively, yes. I'm not saying it's a guarantee, but I think there's reason to think that we're getting close and that the numbers that we're seeing now look similar to the numbers that come out from simulation modeling studies that would provide likely a level of community protection. The one point that you made, though, is that it is state by state. And so I think there is no national story around community immunity. It depends very much where you live, and it is state by state. But I think in Massachusetts, we have reason to think that we're getting close. I just want to be careful. That doesn't mean we should take our foot off the gas. Even better than, you know, two-thirds vaccinated would be 100% vaccinated, and that would provide even more protection. So I'm not saying that we should slow down now, but I also think that we should celebrate the win and be excited about where we are.
I just want to put the numbers out that, so that we can get callers in line. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus question, and I will go to the calls in just a moment. But first, Dr. Andujar Vazquez, that comes. So here we are at this moment in the Commonwealth. But on the same day, we find out that nationally, we're not going to reach the goal that President Biden had for July 4th. Now, it was a little bit of a different goal. It was 70% of adults with at least one shot in the arm. by July 4th. What do you make of that, the success, you know, relative success here in the Commonwealth, and that inability to hit a big mark that the president wanted to hit nationally?
Right. You know, I think that we still, like I said, and I think Dr. Linus pointed out, that we still have a lot of work to do in different states, particularly that goal about 70% by July 1st of the adults. You know, the proportion of that number, if you look, go into detail into the age groups, it seems that we're seeing just a little bit behind vaccination rate in the young adults, right, 18 to 30 years of age, where we still see that we're not reaching out to that group as much as we would like to. And but if you see the numbers from 30 years above, and you know, the 65 and older, we're reaching, even in different states, we're reaching a good goal of more than 70, not all of them, not all states in the nation. So I think that what that reflects is that we still have a lot of work ahead nationally to make sure that we reach out to those groups that are still hesitant to get vaccinated.
We're going to come back to that, but I want to go to the phones now. 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first caller. Megan's on the line in Watertown. Hi, Megan. What's your question?
Hi. So I am a teacher with school-age kids who are not yet eligible for a vaccine. They're under 12. And with everything opening up, I was wondering how I can best protect my kids if I come in contact with the coronavirus or the Delta variant. How the vaccine, like, does it bounce off me? Like, should I keep my mask on?
Okay, so Megan, just to clarify your question, you are vaccinated. You are concerned about whether if you come in contact with the Delta variant, there's some risk of you spreading it to the kids in your classroom who are not yet age eligible for a vaccine, correct?
Correct.
Okay, let's turn to Dr. Linus.
Sure, it's a great question. So the good news is the vaccine remains effective against the Delta variant. So I would say the generalized first response to anyone asking, what can I do to keep the people around me safer, be they family or students, is to get vaccinated. Once you're vaccinated, that's fantastic. It's probably about a 90% risk in transmission to your students. If you combine that with some social distancing in the classroom, and also we're still wearing masks in classrooms now, I think there is no risk to your students, or effectively none. And that's really what we've seen all spring since coming back into schools. We really have not seen a lot of COVID in schools, even amongst the unvaccinated. So I think there's a lot of reason to feel good that you can keep your kids safe and keep moving forward with education. And I think the hard decisions will come. There's another hard decision coming this summer about what the rule for masking should be amongst unvaccinated students in the fall. And I think those are discussions that are going to have to be had this summer.
Do you have questions about kids and vaccinations? Do you have questions about still when to mask and when not to mask? Maybe you have questions about the Delta variant. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's stick with masks for a second, Dr. Andujar Vasquez. We continue to get questions every time we do ask the doctors, with people just not sure when they need to mask to keep others safe, especially people who are vaccinated but concerned that perhaps they could carry the virus and not be aware, you know, be asymptomatic. So can you kind of give us the general, quick, easy guidelines when to mask, when not to mask?
Right. So if you're vaccinated, you really, if you're indoor or outdoor, it really is very unlikely that if you're not wearing a mask and you are among other people that are vaccinated, that you or unvaccinated, that you will transmit that virus, even if you're asymptomatic. There's really been very little number of breakthrough infections in people that are fully vaccinated. And when they actually have infections, they are asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic, and there has not been proved that there's been secondary transmission. And by secondary transmission, I mean that a fully vaccinated person will transmit that virus to another person, whether they're vaccinated or not. Now, wearing unvaccinated, basically outdoors, is okay for everyone to not be wearing a mask at this point, but indoors, they should be wearing a mask. And when they're not able to wear a mask, they should be socially distancing.
All right. And let's now pick up on the Delta variant, Dr. Linus. Latest data is the Delta variant makes up about 14% of cases, but it's spreading rapidly. How soon before it is the dominant variant in the United States?
I can't tell you exactly when that would happen, but I would expect this summer. And at this point, I think when we're talking about COVID, we should just make plans as if we're talking about the Delta variant, because I think it's likely to take over.
And what does that mean?
Well, it depends if you're vaccinated. Again, the world is really starting, the pandemic world is beginning to divide along vaccinated versus unvaccinated lines. If you're vaccinated, the Delta variant is something to note, and it brings some questions about whether it could produce a long tail to the epidemic. But for your personal safety, going to the store, going to your events, or doing your daily life, the Delta variant doesn't actually have a lot of meaning to you because you're vaccinated and you're protected. If you're not vaccinated, the Delta variant should be of major concern. We've seen it driving huge outbreaks in India and in the UK as well. If you're not vaccinated, you're at risk for that outcome. So I think that in the unvaccinated world, the Delta variant is something to be very concerned about. And that's a good reason to get vaccinated. That's why there's been a consistent message from all of us over and over again that vaccination is important. And the Delta variant just ups the ante on that statement.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus question. Sam from Newton, you are on the line. Go ahead.
Thank you. What is the risk of going to a folk dance camp locally where there'll be approximately 150 people who are all vaccinated? All dancing is held outside, kind of circle dancing, and we're sleeping overnight, and everyone's sleeping in a single room. And the question is, should all participants with grandchildren get a PCR test after that 3 days of dancing camp?
Well, the camp sounds like a blast, Sam. I hope that you are able to go. And let's ask Dr. Andu Har-Vasquez about the PCR testing question.
Correct. Yeah. If everyone participating in this camp, which is outdoors, and everyone's vaccinated, the likelihood of transmission of COVID is very, very low. And I would say, go beyond to say that it's probably safe, very safe. I don't necessarily think that testing after an activity like this is if everyone was vaccinated, it needs to happen. Particularly if you have no symptoms. Obviously, we always say testing is always needed, even if you're vaccinated, if you have any symptoms. But if you remain asymptomatic, I don't believe that if everyone's fully vaccinated that you need to have testing.
All right, let's pick up another call. 800-423-8255 is the number. Leon's on the line from Marblehead. Leon, what's your question?
My question is about the difference between natural immunity and the immunity acquired as a result of a vaccine. For example, I'm 61 years old, and I had COVID about 3-4 months ago. Now, I had read studies from Europe that natural immunity lasts for a pretty long time. So my question is also, why should I get vaccinated if I had COVID? And it was official. I got tested positive, and I had it.
So, Leon, I'm glad you're okay after having had it. And let's turn to Dr. Linus with your question. Dr. Linus, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really important question. So thanks for bringing it to the air. I shared your skepticism early on. I was like, really? Do we need to be vaccinating already infected people, especially if we have limited doses of vaccine? But it turns out that it looks like that the immunity provided by the vaccine is different than the immunity provided by natural infection, and perhaps actually stronger and more durable. And so that's why the guidance now is that even if you've been infected, you should be vaccinated, because we just know more about the immunity that's provided by the vaccine. And there's actually increasing data coming out now that from vaccine, we're gaining things like immune cells in bone marrow that are signs of long-term durable immunity. But these are the memory cells that help us fight the chickenpox 30 years later. There's a lot of evidence that the immunity we're getting from the current vaccine should be long-term durable, certainly more than 6 months or a year. And that's why we're asking everyone to please get vaccinated, even if you were infected before, because we think the immunity is stronger from the vaccine, and we think it lasts longer. And it, even if we're wrong, we just don't know about the natural immunity. And in this time, in this pandemic, we just want to know what we're dealing with. And so please do go get vaccinated.
All right. Thanks for that answer. Let's pick up another call, 800-423-8255, to ask your question. Cecilia's on the line in Needham. Hi, Cecilia. Your turn.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me on. I wanted to ask you, my husband is an elementary school teacher. He's been vaccinated. He taught remotely this past year, but I was concerned about what it would be like for him to go back to school in the fall.
Now, is there a special circumstance with your husband, Cecilia?
Sorry, yes, I forgot to mention he is immunocompromised and on oral chemotherapy.
Okay, thank you for that. Dr. Andujar Vasquez.
Right. So with the immunocompromised patients, even when they're vaccinated, we do still advise that they continue to do some of the safety measures that may be immunocompetent, people that don't have issues with their immune system, and are fully vaccinated would not have to be careful with. And by that, I mean, for example, for your husband, he's fully vaccinated, which is great, but we just don't know, depending on their immune system, how they will respond to the vaccine, right? Whether their immune response will be very robust or whether their immune response would be a little bit weakened just because their immunity is not that great. So we would still recommend, you know, masking and indoors and trying to basically hang out only with vaccinated people. Acknowledging that your husband is in school, right, a teacher, kids are less likely to at this point to contract, right, transmit the disease, even though they are able to. And with the community spread being so low in Massachusetts, the likelihood of in this fall of him contracting COVID-19 while fully vaccinated and wearing a mask in the schools is very low. So I think it's a balance.
All right. Now, before we take maybe one last call, I want to bring in another voice. We have been doing Ask the Doctors since March of 2020. And in that time, we have gained a family of infectious disease specialists who have shared their talent, their wisdom with us, with our callers. And today we are saying goodbye to one member of that family, Dr. Joshua Barocas, who is headed to the University of Colorado School of Medicine's Division of Infectious Diseases and Division of General Internal Medicine. So he is on the road, but we invited him to phone in so we could give him a proper send-off. Dr. Barocas, thanks for stopping by.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much, Tiziana. This is very, very nice of you all.
We are so happy to have you. Go ahead. Say what you were going to say.
No. We pulled off the road so that I'm safe and not talking while driving.
So, Dr. Linus, you're chuckling. I understand that Dr. Barocas is a mentee of yours, or as you described, your professional little brother. Any advice for Dr. Barocas as he heads off?
Well, this is a remarkable opportunity. We've said our goodbyes, but to have an opportunity to say thank you to Josh and to tell the world what a remarkable scientist he is and what a fantastic colleague and mentee. And my advice is to just embrace this opportunity. It's going to be fantastic as you start your own group and head out to Colorado. And Boston will miss you, but the world is going to be better for you being in it. So thank you so much, and best for your whole family and to everyone.
And Dr. Barocas, words of wisdom from you. You know, what has been being on the front line this past year taught you about the world, about yourself, about our community?
Yeah, well, first I have to say that the service that you've done, Tiziana, and the Radio Boston crew has just been remarkable over the past 16 months. You've effectively been there the entire time with us, and I think that many of us have felt supported because of the work that you've done. I'll say, and I think I said this early on in the pandemic, perhaps one of the first times that we were on together, that one of the most remarkable things, there's been so much devastation, so much heartbreak, so much just pain through the last 14 months, 15 months, 16 months. But what we've seen is that when tragedy strikes, people can come together and people can put aside differences. And I think that going forward, the biggest lesson that we can all take from this is that when we use the collective sort of human spirit, the collective human intelligence, and the collective human empathy, what we can achieve is just remarkable.
That's fantastic. Would you like to take one last call on your way out?
I'm happy to. Absolutely. Anything.
All right, Lisa.
Anything from
Lisa,
Boston.
That's great. Lisa from Peabody. Go ahead.
Hi, Tatiana. I have two comments and two questions, and I'll be quick.
Lisa, I'm sorry. We don't have time for that. Lisa, just one question, please.
All right. You mentioned that somebody that can be vaccinated could also carry the virus and be asymptomatic. And like my daughter also had COVID, do I have to vaccine her? And what's the percentage of people that have been vaccinated could be carrying the virus?
Thank you for that. Dr. Barocas.
So it's very, very, very unlikely that someone can get COVID once they've been vaccinated. We know that this happens. There are breakthrough cases. We expect this to happen, but we know that it's going to be less severe COVID. People are going to stay out of the hospital. People are going to avoid death. So even if you, your daughter, have been vaccinated, you still have a chance of getting it. If you haven't been vaccinated and you've had COVID, then this is the moment for you to get vaccinated because it does reduce your risk of severe infection. And we say this over and over, it's not the magic bullet, but it is one of the tools in the toolbox that we have.
Well, what a pleasure. You know, Dr. Gabriela Andujar Vasquez, you are one of our newest members, and now we're saying goodbye to one of the oldest members of our family in terms of duration on Ask the Doctors, Dr. Barocas. We wish you best, Dr. Barocas. So that was Dr. Benjamin Linus of Boston Medical Center, Dr. Gabriela Andujar Vasquez of Tufts Medical Center, and Dr. Joshua Barocas, soon to be in Colorado. Thanks to all three of you for doing Ask the Doctors.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thanks. Drive safe, Josh.
Legos have shown up everywhere from the Kennedy Space Center to the bottoms of your feet when they're left on the floor. Ouch. Now, one Newton man has turned them into a career, using them for STEM and STEAM education through his nonprofit, Next Gen Smarty Pants. His name is Paris Patani, a.k.a. Mr. Lego. And those Lego skills have landed him a coveted spot out of 25,000 applicants on the second season of Fox's Lego Masters, which he describes as the Olympics for the Lego community. Paris holds many titles, robotics engineer, founder and CEO, Lego Master, but as he told us when we spoke to him recently, it is the title of dad that has been his biggest inspiration. Paris talked about how when he had his daughter, who's now 9, his focus changed completely.
I had been quite overachiever in things and been to 45 countries and all that, but having her, none of that mattered anymore. It was really about helping her to have the best life that she could have. And so part of that was I learned really quickly that she was just bored in school. It just wasn't challenging enough, and I didn't think that was fair. So we just started building, you know, and Lego was a great medium.
Yeah. How old was she when you started building?
You know, we'd been building together right from day one, really. But I would say the epiphany seminal moment was when she was not quite 4. She wanted to add lights to one of her Lego sets. And so I taught her some very basic soldering and circuit. She was really very self-motivated to want to add the lights. She didn't care really what she had to learn to get there. So rather than sort of, at least from my days in school, it was more about, you know, doing like 100 math problems and not really knowing why. This was sort of a pull, if you will. And it just really hit me like a ton of bricks, or I guess that's punny now, but.
A ton of Lego bricks. Gotcha.
Yeah, a ton of Lego bricks. That's right.
So, Paris, I want to play a little sound, a clip of you and your daughter working with Legos together. Here it is.
So, where is the missing? Yippadoodoo.
Yippadoodoo.
Why did I just say that?
I'm not sure why.
And what does it mean?
That I'm not sure about either.
And what are you sure about?
I'm sure that I'm not sure about that.
You made one for me?
I made one for you.
Okay.
So, Paris, I can hear the love, right? I can hear the love in that and the joy of being with your daughter. How do we get from there to you're on a reality show on Fox building master Legos, and you've got a master Lego builder plaque in your house.
Well, you know, a lot of success, I think, is 50% perseverance and 50% luck, as the saying goes. I've been running Next Gen Smarty Pants for about 5 years. I've been in the press quite a bit. And, you know, we integrate all of our programs. The school systems use us as sort of the lab, the hands-on application of the math skills and science skills that they teach. And we use Lego for about 80% of our programs. And so
and you work in schools in Massachusetts and Connecticut, right?
That's right. Yep. So mostly in Connecticut. Like I said, they just gave me a call back in December, I think it was. And they asked if I'd be interested to apply. And actually, I thought it was spam at first. And I happened to be on the phone with one of the Lego masters from the previous year, Jessica Ragsey, and she's now teaching some of our Lego classes, for example. And I just said to her, I said, you know, I got a message from them. Do you think that's real? And she's like, oh, absolutely. You should call back. I'm like, really? And I mean, even then, going through that process was quite arduous. And I didn't really think I would make it.
My understanding is something like 25,000 people apply and 12 teams of two make it. So for them to invite you into the application screen and for you to make it, you really had to go through a lot.
Oh, yeah. They put us through the ringer, that's for sure. We definitely had to do certain challenges. They asked to build multiple things. So they really judge on three things, which is creativity, technical capabilities, and then storytelling. And so you really have to be at the top of your game on those three aspects.
What are you best at?
Well, the engineering, the technical capabilities, for sure. The use of robotics and gears and pulleys and pneumatics and all these things. That's what I'm really known for, is using these components to teach.
So I want to play a clip of you on Lego Masters working with your teammate, because you do have a teammate on the show, Michael Moto Kanemoto of Colorado. Here it is.
Hello there, Moto and Paris.
Hi there.
I can see you've got some robots in action there already.
We're both engineers and we're both dads, so it made sense to build two dad robots, one with a little girl and one with a little boy.
How are you going to incorporate some playful motion into your build?
But we're moving a gearbox into the chest cavity so we can get the torso to move this way. He's got a gearbox designed to get the arms to move this way, and then we're going to do one more mechanism to get the head to go this way.
So can you tell us how that one turned out?
That was from episode one, and we made the robots. Moto is an engineer as well, so he and I had some different discussions about how we would do certain things, especially with the head and the neck and things. I remember our head fell off the first time, but then we kind of fixed it. And But, you know, if you watch that episode, I mean, the artistry is amazing. And Moto is quite well known in the Lego community, and has quite a bit of a following for his artistry. So my perspective was really trying to help elevate, you know, our art by bringing my engineering skills into it.
You talk about other folks who are well known for their artistry. You're on these teams. It's extremely competitive on air, of course, because it's a competitive reality show. Was it competitive behind the scenes? Take us behind the scenes of an episode. What was that experience like?
In short, no. It really wasn't competitive. The word Lego means play well. So it was, I think, frustrating for some of the production crew because we kept helping each other. In general, our technic and engineering skills were much higher than all the others, and their artistry was so much better. So we just kept collaborating. We just kept helping each other. And they would ask us to actually stop doing that because we're competition. And I mean, we did it anyway. We just kind of did it off camera.
Is that collaboration, things that you learned, are you able to bring them back into these courses that you are using Legos to teach through your nonprofit to help young people with STEAM and adults, as I understand it, with STEAM as well, science, technology, engineering, art, and math?
Yeah, we have lots of adults that take our classes. My mother in particular loves our animals robotics class. But yeah, from a Lego building, even, you know, if you ask a child to build something, they typically will just dig their hands in and build this sort of polka dot mass. And what we do is we try to get them from that to symmetry, rule of thirds, dominant color, shape, you know, and start to think about purposeful design, sort of expressing their own artistic style. And then we start bringing in gears and motors and technical components.
So what's one thing you learned from another competitor on the show that kind of blew your Lego mind?
I'd say the single greatest thing is just these relationships. And we still all talk every single day. We call it our Lego Masters 2 family. From an educational standpoint, I really learned a lot about how different artists do things. And I've integrated that and really tried to apply a lot of the skills. So it was really about the melding of engineering and artistry, kind of like what Steve Jobs used to profess about. You know, it's the art that really emotionally connects with people. It's the engineering that really helps us to do and things that are incredible. And the combination of the two is sort of the sweet spot.
What's the best thing you've ever built with Legos Paris?
Well, I have a 2-foot-tall ice cream cone. That's pretty fun.
What makes it fun? Because obviously you can't eat it.
You can't eat it, no. What's so great about it is the technical challenge, the brick techniques and stuff. As an engineer, I'm kind of nerdy that way. I love to learn different technique. From an artistic standpoint, it's just, what, a 2-foot-tall ice cream cone? What? So it really connects with kids and people. And it's enlightening. It's inspiring, I think. I can't give more of a gift to kids in particular than that.
The engineering challenge, is it the roundness of what would be the scoops and doing that with square Legos? Is that what the big engineering challenge there was?
So, yes. So the scoops themselves, it was really about getting the weight out and still being able to hold a globe sort of shape. And the cone in particular, I used a spiral technique. And so making the cone shape and then being able to put it all together and having the cone hold. It's got three
not
scoops
collapse.
On it. Yeah, that's right. I haven't really brought it out, but I know the kids are going to want to take pictures with it. So I think I'm going to have to use some acetone to weld all the plastic together.
When you get Legos now in a box, it's with a pattern, and you're supposed to build something, like a Star Wars Millennium Falcon, for example. But then there's free building, where you just use your imagination and you have lots of Legos and you see what you can build. And my understanding is people sort of fall in one camp or the other. Where do you fall on that? And are there really these camps?
Yes, a little bit. Ever since I came back from the Lego Masters production, my perspective has definitely changed. I'm not interested in the Lego sets nearly as much as I used to be, because now I know some of the designers and whatnot. And I think the real reason is that I'd rather try and see what I can do. I've always been looking at different Lego sets and looking at the different techniques that a lot of these professional designers do and use. Now it's more of looking at those techniques and seeing how I can use them, you know, in a different context. And what am I learning from building the set?
What's your dream build with your daughter?
If I had the opportunity, the Lego bricks, the time, the independence, I would love to build Willy Wonka's chocolate factory out of Lego.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is Paris Patani, also known as Mr. Lego, who is a contender on the second season of Lego Masters and the founder and CEO of Next Gen Smarty Pants, which is a nonprofit education corporation. Paris, good luck. And thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And you can watch Paris and his teammate Moto compete on Lego Masters on Fox tonight at 8. Finally today, we want to bring you the story of a remarkable and complicated Boston woman, Annie Cohen Kupchovsky, a Latvian immigrant living in the West End. She was a wife and a mother of three. And if you had been around in the 1890s, you might better know her as Annie Londonderry, a 23-year-old woman who this week in 1894 began an extraordinary journey around the world on a bicycle. She was one half P.T. Barnum, one half Susan B. Anthony, and a third half Nellie Bly. Her story captured the zeitgeist of the times, the women's suffrage movement, extraordinary tales told in the newspaper, and of course, a healthy dose of snake oil. And she is at the center of the story in a new book by local author Peter Zeutlin. His new book is Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana. It's great to be here.
So, Peter, what a woman. I just gave a quick review of Annie Londonderry. You wrote this book and a previous one about her in 2007. Tell us who she was.
Well, you did a great job summing it up. She was this young mother married in her late teens with three young kids by the time she was about 23 years old, living in this tenement in the West End, not particularly happy with her life and looking for a means of escape. And she found it on a bicycle.
So tell us what her life would have been.
Her life would have been more of the same, pretty much drudgery. You know, she once told her granddaughter she didn't want to have another child under her apron every year. She was cleaning, she was shopping, she was cooking, she was actually working outside the home as an advertising solicitor for the Boston newspapers. But living in the West End, she was exposed to people from all corners of the world. It was one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the United States at the time. And I think for anyone with an imagination that took them beyond the banks of the Charles River, it was a community that would have inspired some curiosity about the world outside the one she was living in.
You know, when I first heard about her, I was like, I'm sorry, what? A woman in the late 1890s biked across the world. Now, and then I find out she'd never even been on a bike before this big wager. Reading the book, I came to a new appreciation also of the role of the bicycle, the history of bicycle for Boston, for women's suffrage, for women's rights. I had no idea there was an intersection there. Tell us about
that. I think this is one of the most underappreciated pieces of history about the women's movement of the time, is how vital the bicycle was in transforming the lives of women who were seeking the vote and seeking social equality. It gave them new mobility. It gave them the exhilaration of freedom of movement. But it wasn't without controversy. A lot of people thought it was absolutely, inappropriate for women to be exerting themselves on a bicycle or showing too much leg, for example. And Susan B. Anthony, actually have her quote on the cover of the book. She said, "Bicycling has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. It changed the way women dressed because they had to adapt their clothing, as Annie did, to the practicalities of cycling. And it was really, getting on a bicycle was a woman's declaration of independence."
So, she pushed her independence in a lot of ways by taking this supposed, and I understand from you, it is a supposed wager. So let's just talk about that for a minute. What started her on a bicycle trip around the world?
Well, the story is it was reported all over the world. And I should say she left a trail of newspaper coverage everywhere she went. I've collected thousands of articles about her. And it's consistently reported that two wealthy Boston merchants were debating one of the major issues of the day, which is women's equality. And the bet was, could a woman do what only a man had done before, which was to circle the world on a bicycle? And why a bicycle? Because bicycling had become such a popular pastime, and women were coming into the sport as bicycles became, as they evolved from those high wheelers into the bicycles that look like the ones we ride today. So it was a debate over women's rights, and those who are old enough to remember, this was sort of an early version of the tennis match between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. and the wager had certain conditions. The woman who made the trip had to do it in 15 months, had to cover 10,000 miles by bicycle, and had to earn the impressive sum of $5,000 en route, starting without a penny in her pocket. So the notion here was, this isn't just going to be a test of a woman's physical endurance and mental fortitude. It's going to be a test of a woman's ability to fend for herself in the world.
You're listening to Radio Boston. We're talking with author Peter Zeutlin about his book Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story of Annie Londonderry making a bicycle trip around the world. You said a minute ago, Peter, that she left a trail of newspaper coverage, so people all around the world knew about her, but you came to know about her in a more personal way, right? Talk
yes.
about that a little bit.
Well, oddly enough, this story was completely unknown to anyone in my family that I knew. This woman was my great-granddaughter, my great-grandfather's sister. my mother and I learned about her in 1993 when we got a letter from a complete stranger who said he was researching the story of the first woman to bike around the world. And he had done a little bit of genealogy research and thought my mother might be a descendant. And it was clear from the connections he made in the letter that he'd found the right family. But my mother had never heard of Annie, never heard of the bike trip. And, you know, over the next several years, I would ask every family member I could think of, who is this woman? Do you know anything about a bike trip? Nothing. Everybody came up completely empty, completely unknown within my own family.
So, you know, I'm struck by that because part of the conceit of the voice in the book is Annie. She's writing. Mm-hmm. She's writing yes. to her granddaughter, Mary, explaining mm-hmm. her life. Mm-hmm. And let's just bring that home, actually, for our listeners. I'm going to ask you to read a bit from the book. It's early mm-hmm. On page 12. You want to go ahead and read?
Yeah, and I'll just say that Mary is Annie's only direct living descendant, her only grandchild, who's now 89 years old. And she writes to her, "Let's be honest. I wasn't a good mother, and I have tried as a kind of restitution, I suppose, to be a good grandmother to you, my only grandchild. I mean, what kind of mother leaves three young children and a husband behind to go gallivanting around the world on a bicycle? I was supposed to love my babies, but I felt, to be frank, detached from them. All the women around me spoke of the maternal instinct, but I didn't have a nurturing bone in my body. I didn't neglect them, well, not until I got on that bicycle, and they were always well-fed and had clean clothes to wear. I have my regrets now, but that's water over the dam. I've never been given much to introspection or looking back, and I still think psychiatry is a bunch of hooey. But it's a fair question you might have. Why was I so distant from my own children? How could I leave them behind for a lark around the world on a wheel? Why didn't I have the maternal instinct almost all women around me did?"
That's author Peter Zeutlin reading from his new book, Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story. It's interesting. She hid her identity when she left, mm-hmm. In part, as the book argues, because for people to rally behind her, being a young mother who'd left her children behind was not an attractive headline. Being Jewish in America was not an attractive headline. She was controversial.
Yes. She completely reinvented herself as someone else along the way. And it was almost never mentioned in the press, because she didn't tell anyone, that she had children and that she was married. There was one small item in the New York World newspaper about a month after she left. That's when I learned that this woman who'd gone around the world left three children behind. It was utterly startling to me, but also gave me hope, because I realized if those children had children, I might be able to find a distant relative who could shed light on this mystery woman. So she did that very sort of archetypical American thing. She reinvented herself completely as a different person. And the name Londonderry, which helped conceal her Jewish heritage, also had a commercial purpose, because she was the first, at least the first woman I can find, who took endorsements. Londonderry was a spring water company based up in New Hampshire, and they were her first corporate sponsor, and she carried a placard on her bike with their logo on it. So she was pioneering sports-related marketing for women, among other things.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of the book, she's basically like a NASCAR driver. She's wearing ribbons all over, and, I mean, her whole body's covered in advertising.
Yeah, well, she had a background in advertising, and she realized, I have to earn $5,000, and the more famous she became, the more advertisers in different cities clamored to rent space on her back or her body or her. And she had like a rate card, depending on what part of her body you wanted to stitch your advertisement to, you paid a greater fee or a lesser fee. And so she was quite a spectacle. And, you know, she understood then the way the captains of Silicon Valley understand now, that attention equaled money. So she was all about becoming as big a spectacle as she could be. She didn't run away to join the circus. She became the circus. You know, she traveled with a pearl-handled revolver. She eventually, for most of the trip, was riding a man's bicycle in men's clothing. She's covered in advertising. and she's out there spinning fantastic tales of danger and adventure, which is why the book is based on a mostly true story, because what I learned researching her story the first time when I wrote the nonfiction version is that the true story of Annie Londonderry includes a laundry list of fabrications, stories she told about her own background, and stories
about the
places
she lied all the time.
I
recognize she was a relative of yours, but let's just say it. She lied all the time.
I thought my job initially was going to be to prove her purchase on the title of First Woman Around the World by Bicycle. And there became a point when it was obvious to me the stories weren't adding up. But then it dawned on me, you know, I've got a more interesting character to wrestle with here than I initially thought. You know, one of the things she loved to tell reporters in her eagerness to, you know, have them spill ink about her, she often said that she was a Harvard medical student. And I was naive. I actually called the registrar's office at Harvard, and they told me we didn't admit women to Harvard Medical School until the 1940s.
And this was 1894, 1895.
This was 1895. She had a very casual relationship with the truth. But it kind of.
So I'm going to stop you there for a second, just because we have limited time, and I want to pick that up. Mm-hmm. We are in a moment where there's a lot of question about the value of truth, especially truth in the media, truth in politicians, truth in public figures. Mm-hmm. Did you think there'd be a particular resonance here?
You know, I didn't really think about that, but except in retrospect, I thought, you know, she was kind of the original, not the original, she wasn't the only purveyor of fake news. You have to remember that this was the era of what was called yellow journalism. This was this over-the-top, sensational journalism that the very competitive papers, particularly in New York, engaged in an attempt to attract readers. You know, the New York World, Pulitzer's flagship paper, for which she wrote her first-person account of this trip, was what you would get if the New York Times had acquired the National Enquirer. You know, kind of a mashup of over-the-top sensation and serious news at the same time. And she was very astute. She had a very modern sense of celebrity. I, you know, if she was alive today, she'd be an Instagram influencer with like 10 million followers. She really knew how to use the tools at her disposal, which were very limited, you know, the Telegraph and the newspapers, to transform herself from this anonymous working mother from Boston into a global celebrity, albeit for a short time.
All right, there's so much more we could discuss, but the end of the show is upon us. Peter Zeutlin is a New York Times bestselling author. His new book on Annie Londonderry is called Spin, a novel based on a mostly true story. Peter, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Bieland. We have help from Ali Audette, Stephen Gelman, and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. And I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.